You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 25th of March 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Not YouTube, not Twitter, RadioAryan.com, which it has always been. And I'm very pleased to say today that we are joined by Max Musson again from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today on this fine, sunny, glorious afternoon?
Yeah, it is an absolutely fine, sunny, glorious afternoon, just as you say. In fact, it's been a really good weekend, actually, and I've had a good family kind of weekend. We've had a birthday to celebrate this weekend, so we had a really good time yesterday, and I'm feeling very refreshed and ready for our broadcast here today.
Well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. I like to be refreshed and ready for these podcasts. Unlike our Parliament and our government, who don't appear to be ready for Brexit in any way whatsoever. I mean, I don't actually know exactly what's going on. I don't think they do either. I mean, at the beginning of last week, the Speaker of the House said that there is no way that Theresa May can put a deal through again to be voted on again, because that would be three times that exactly the same deal has been put before the Parliament because they keep voting in the wrong way. So he said there's no way that that can be allowed. And then the EU come in and they say, well, we will grant your extension to Article 50, but only if you pass Theresa May's deal. And it looks like they are going to break the tradition of what the Speaker said in order to satisfy the EU's demands. On top of that, they said if the deal fails and it doesn't get voted on, then they're only going to allow a short extension into April, I believe. They're not going to allow an extension into May, because that would mean that we would have to take part in the EU elections, which of course would mean a landslide win for all the anti-European Union parties. And now that we've got to the end of last week, over the weekend, we are hearing that of a coup. There's a coup plotted against Theresa May, and it's on both sides, basically. It's the Remainers that are saying she's got to go, and they want to put in a caretaker prime minister who was originally the David Cameron's Minister for Europe, and he's a dyed-in-the-wool Remainer. And then on the other side, you've got Michael Gove that is being put forward as a Brexiteer. And of course, it needs to be a Brexiteer so that he does actually want to leave the EU. But apparently Michael Gove is a bit of a soft Brexiteer, and he wants to stay within the customs union. And also, obviously, Labour want Theresa May to go. I mean, everybody wants Theresa May to go. And they're talking in all the newspapers this weekend that she could be gone within 10 days. If she says she will leave, then she might be able to get her deal passed. But again, how can they put that deal through again the third time? You know, that's exactly the same as saying, well, we're going to have the referendum again because you guys didn't vote right the first time. You need to vote the way we want you to vote. And now it's voting the way the European Union want them to vote. I mean, it really couldn't be any clearer to everyone, I think, that that deal is the EU's deal. It's not a British deal. It's not to the benefit of the British people. It's what the EU want. And Theresa May has been tasked with selling it to the British people and selling it to the British government. And they're just not having it, because it doesn't satisfy either the Leavers or the Remainers, because all it satisfies is what the EU wants. And that must be so clear now that she is just a European Union puppet. What I would like to see happen is for them to say, look, we've had enough of this. We're going to leave on the 29th of March, which is what it says in law still. That is still the default legal position. And once we have left, there will be a general election And the direction that it goes after that will be directed by whoever wins the general election. I think that would be the most sensible way of dealing with this. What are your thoughts on that, Max? And I know you've actually found some write-ups of European Union stuff in rather an unexpected source as well that you wanted to tell listeners about.
Yes, yes. I mean, I thoroughly agree with your assessment of the situation, really. It's a diabolical situation. It just goes to show that the rulings by John Bercow, the Speaker of the House, last week, preventing Theresa May from presenting her bill for the last time, it was just a load of nonsense. The fact that they're now able to do it again just because the European Union wants us to. I think it's fairly plain that we as a nation now face a humiliation and a disgrace that is worse than that suffered by the Germans after the First World War when they were forced to sign the Treaty of Versailles. I think what's happened over Brexit will be our Treaty of Versailles that will fester in the hearts of our people for decades to come, where we look back at a period where our Prime Minister had to go to Brussels and make a 90-minute presentation to them, asking them and in reality pleading with them to provide her with an extension so that she didn't have to actually lead us through into a no-deal Brexit. And then she was asked to leave the room while the European Union leaders from the other member states discussed our fate and decided what the fate of Britain would be. And then she was summoned back into the room so that they could deliver to her the outcome of their conversation. And it is an utterly humiliating thing for us as a nation to actually sort of face this. And I think anybody, whether they are voted leave or whether they voted remain, will recognise the fact that we have been, as a nation, thoroughly humiliated by this process that we've been through. And the process that we've been through, this process of humiliation, makes it absolutely plain, even to those people who were Remainers, that the European Union have effectively frustrated the will of the British electorate. Whether you were a Remainer or not, and whether as a Remainer you agreed with the decision that was made at the referendum for us to leave, what is patently obvious is that a democratically arrived at decision by the British electorate has been frustrated by machinations of the European Parliament, by the other European leaders, and by the machinations of the pro-European lobby within the Houses of Parliament, basically. And so in that, the vast majority of people who voted for us to leave the European Union did so because there is this general feeling, not just in this country, but in other countries within the European Union, that the government of the European Union is completely detached from the will of the people. What's happened is that we voted because in objection to the fact that the European government is totally detached from the will of the people. And then we've had our own MPs at Westminster demonstrating again that they are totally detached from the will of the people by using political shenanigans to frustrate Brexit process. And they've contrived, together with their counterparts in the European Union, to frustrate the Brexit process. And they have, in fact, demonstrated that, yes, the Parliament of both Britain and the European Union is divorced and totally alien in terms of its preparedness to deliver what is the will of the electorate in this country. And there could be no clearer demonstration of the fact that democracy is in a crisis state now, because what we have is this very clear example, as I say, of the fact that democracy no longer exists, certainly in Britain and throughout the whole of Europe in reality, because if any other European country had attempted to do what we've done, then the same thing would have happened to them. And so democracy doesn't exist. And we are people who are accorded a vote. We can vote in elections, but our vote just really doesn't count. Unless, of course, we vote in the way that the political elites within the world today decide they would like us to vote. And that's something that everybody, whether they are whether they voted Leave or whether they voted Remain at the referendum, needs to think very seriously about. Is that the kind of world? Is that the kind of world? Is that the kind of political system that you want to pass on to the next generation, pass on to your children, etc.? And it's a very serious question that we all have to answer. On a lighter note, you mentioned these articles that I've just been sort of chuckling with you about. And yes, I've noticed through reading the articles on the Guardian website, because I try to read a very broad range of articles so that I don't just read articles that agree with me. I read articles that I patently disagree with. And I just discovered on the Guardian website some articles written by a sketch writer called John Crace. And John Crace has spent a fair bit of recent time apparently ridiculing Theresa May because of the contradictions within her behaviour. And he was the person who first nicknamed her the Maybot, which I believe is derived from the ridiculous dancing sessions that she did a while back, where she was dancing pretty much like a robot and making a complete fool of herself in a kind of a Commonwealth or during a Commonwealth tour. But now he's named her LINO, which is an acronym for LINO, which stands for Leader in Name Only. And he says that, like LINO, she's hard to nail down but easy to walk over. And during the course of the last week, he's written three or four articles that have all been absolutely hilarious. And I would heartily advise anybody who is critical of what Theresa May's been doing to have a read of these, even people that are not critical of what she's been doing, because they are genuinely funny, irrespective of your political viewpoint. And I was chuckling away at these. And if I'd had a bit more time to prepare for today, I perhaps could have sorted out a few quotations from them, in fact, that would have hammered that point home. But have a look at the Guardian website, have a look at the articles written by John Crace. They're well worth a read, and that they will tickle you, I'm sure.
Yeah, Lino sounds like the right name for her. She's certainly not a lion, a British lion. And when you're talking there, I think what you're saying is counterfeit democracy. That's what we have. It's a counterfeit democracy. It's not a real democracy. We're just going through the motions. We're just told that our votes matter. We go through all the exercise of having elections. We instruct them in what we want them to do, and then they don't do it. And all the children at school, they get taught what a wonderful thing democracy is and how it means that every member of society has their say in who it is that's guiding the direction of the country. And it's all just a farce. I mean, this has just shown that it's a farce. And I do like your analogy there with the Versailles Treaty. I mean, I hadn't thought of that before, but I guess there is a craze for singing Anna Soubry is a Nazi. That's come about over the last couple of months, which fits in with your analogy there, that we're being like Germany, we are being humiliated, and this is the way that it will be remembered in years to come. I don't know where it's going to go next week, but if they do end up putting a deal through again after the Speaker has said that can't be done, and just doing it purely because the EU have directed them to, I mean, that's just shocking to me that they can just bend tradition, bend the constitution at the will of the EU 3 years after we instructed them to leave. 3 years after everybody thought we were going to leave the next day. David Cameron said Article 50 will be enacted the very next day. He said that he will step down because somebody needed to lead the country that was a Brexiteer, and we got Theresa May, who has just bumbled along from one calamity to the next. I think she's going to go down in history as the worst prime minister that we have ever had. To be honest, I'm just fed up to the back teeth of these female politicians. They're dreadful. All of them are dreadful. There's one that isn't. The leader of the DUP. I think she's pretty good. But when you think of the one that leads Scotland, when you think of this Jacinda Ardern, this one from New Zealand, I've never really seen her before, but she's dreadful. She's like Justin Trudeau in drag. So apparently she used to lead the World Socialist League. She's been wearing headscarves in solidarity with Muslims. She removed the words Jesus Christ from the opening prayers to Parliament. And then last week, she had the Muslim call to prayer start Parliament. And she also had it blare out on the radio. And that call to prayer is basically Islamic supremacy. It's Islamic supremacy saying that there is no other God other than the Islamic God. And that was booming out of all the radios. That was said at the start of Parliament. And this was all instituted by this Jacinda Ardern. And the Muslims love her so much, they projected a huge vision of her face onto the tallest building in the world that's in Abu Dhabi. So you can just imagine this huge face of Jacinda Ardern with her goofy teeth staring down on all these Arabs. She's an absolute hero to them for the way that she has just turned everything over to Islam. She's also banned guns, and basically, I mean, she's banned guns in New Zealand, assault weapons, which they used to be able to have. I mean, they never had any trouble with guns before over there. And if they take the guns away, they're not going to be able to defend themselves against actions happening like this mosque murder. I mean, there were reports of how he was prevented from actually carrying on with any more of his murderous rampage by somebody with a gun. And if they take the guns away, that's not going to be allowed to happen. But of course, but both those things, the solidarity with Islam, bending over backwards for them and removing the guns, that's exactly what the killer wanted. That's what he outlined in his manifesto. That is what he wanted. So it does look like the politicians are doing exactly what this killer wanted in his manifesto, and nationalists are doing the opposite of what he wanted. We're saying violence is not the answer. Going out and shooting people is not the answer to society's problems. It's not the answer to the problems that he outlines in his manifesto. So once again, you know, it's topsy-turvy world. The governments are doing what the killer wanted, and the nationalists are doing the exact opposite of what the killer wanted, and yet the nationalists are being reported in the news as if we are the ones responsible for this, as if we are supporting this. It's not us supporting it. It's Jacinda Ardern doing exactly what he hoped that massacre would achieve. Now, I know you've been looking into this as well, Max. Normally we cover British news, but since this is news all over the world, and particularly in Britain, we might as well concentrate on it for a little bit here. I think you've been looking at some of the responses to it and some of the strange bedfellows that Jacinda Ardern has been making at some of these vigils. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think as far as the British connection is concerned, New Zealand, the bulk of the population of New Zealand is of British extraction, and I think a lot of, particularly during the old sort of empire days and the Commonwealth days, people tended to regard New Zealand as another England created over the other side of the world. And a lot of people here in the UK, we look at the developments that are taking place here in the UK and imagine what life is going to be like in 20 years' time for our children and further into the future for our grandchildren. And I think a lot of people take heart from the thought that if the worst comes to the worst here in England, they could always up sticks and emigrate to Australia or emigrate to New Zealand, and there they would find a new England created across the other side of the world, unsullied in the way that our England here on these islands has been sullied. But that's no longer the case. And the shooting that took place and the reaction of The New Zealand government has demonstrated that New Zealand actually is every bit as multicultural, has gone every bit as far down that path as we have here in the UK. And I think the figures show that something like 14 or 15% of the population of New Zealand are of non-white, non-British extraction, and which is pretty comparable to the situation over here in the UK. And so New Zealand is another UK now, rather than being the way England and the UK used to be in times gone by, which is, as I say, what some people continue to imagine. And there are some strange bedfellows. I mean, one of the things that sort of struck me was that I think it was last Sunday there was a haka performed by a group of bikers just to honour the dead from Christchurch. And this haka was carried out by a group that were called Black Power. And it just sort of caught my eye that they were called Black Power. And there was another group that was involved in that they've been providing security at some of these memorial events and things that have been held over the last...
Hang on a minute, Max. So they're called Black Power. Can you just imagine if there was a dance troupe calling themselves White Power that had gone to one of the Manchester bombing vigils or any of the Muslim terrorist attacks around Europe? If there'd been a group there calling themselves White Power that was there at the vigil, what do you think the response would have been?
I mean, well, pretty obviously they would have been shunned, and if they hadn't gone away pretty sharpishly, then I think they probably would have got arrested and treated quite quite disparagingly by the authorities. And yeah, you've picked up on the point, which is what made me originally start looking at this, that there was this group called Black Power. They were originally called the Black Bulls when they started, but then they were renamed Black Power when the Black Power movement became prominent in the United States. And they have a patch, which is their kind of logo that they have on the back of their jackets, and that they this patch says Mangu Kaha, which apparently is Maori for Black Power, and then Aotearoa, however you pronounce that, which apparently is supposed to mean Land of the Long White Cloud, which apparently is Maori for New Zealand.
Are they a biker gang or something? Is that why they're wearing these patches?
They are a biker gang as well. That's right. And this other group called the Mongrel Mob are also a biker gang. And it's just really quite strange that that they've been given such prominence, and I can only think that the fact that they are predominantly Maori and Polynesian in terms of their composition makes people like Jacinda Ardern and other sort of knee-jerk liberal snowflakes over there in New Zealand think that therefore they must be okay. They must be the sort of people, you know, because they are an ethnic minority, a non-white ethnic minority, that they must be the sort of people that we would want to, or that they would want to perform at these kind of events in order to push home the multicultural nature that she would like to, and people like her would like to present of New Zealand to the world. And yet, in fact, as you say, they call themselves Black Power. Had they called themselves White Power, it would have been in an entirely different kettle of fish. But the Mongrel Mob are quite interesting because they've been going for something like about 60 years now. And the Mongrel Mob apparently were originally composed of Europeans, because there weren't that many non-Europeans in New Zealand at the time. But over the years, the Maori and Polynesian and Asian population of New Zealand has increased dramatically. And so now they are almost exclusively, both gangs, Maori and Polynesian. And they fight each other. They are like enemies. And they often have punch-ups and shootings of each other. As far as the Mongrel Mob are concerned, if you have a look on their Wikipedia page, you'll see that they that they are involved, according to the New Zealand police, in drug trafficking, in weapons trafficking, which is interesting in view of Jacinda Ardern's move to make military assault rifles illegal. That they're involved in weapons trafficking, they're involved in extortion, they've been involved in serious assaults, in murders and robberies, in theft and in money laundering. And the Black Power people, they've been involved in drug dealing, assaults and murders as well. And so here they are, a very disreputable, two very disreputable groups, basically, who are effectively criminal gangs. But because they happen to be predominantly of Maori and Polynesian extraction, regarded as being okay. You know, that's like a sort of sort of get out of jail free card and a golden ticket to be able to parade around at these at the memorial events for the people that were killed in the Christchurch shooting. Interestingly also, the Mungle mob, their patch originally featured a bulldog wearing a Stahlhelm, which is the German Second World War helmet. And they also included a swastika on their patch. And their greeting up until the Christchurch shooting was "Sieg Heil." Now, you couldn't actually find anything more surreal than that a group of a biker gang, which is a criminal gang involved in all sorts of criminal activities, that has a bulldog wearing a Stahlhelm and a swastika on their logo and has the greeting of "Sieg Heil" would be honoured and treated with all great deference, etc., when they appear to do a haka at a shooting where a white supremacist apparently shot a large number of Muslims. And it's just a really bizarre situation.
Mongrel privilege, that's what it is. That's what I call it, mongrel privilege. I
mean, it is, the Black Power group as well. I mean, there was in 2005 a quite highly publicised occasion where two members of the Black Power gang were convicted of child abuse for beating a two-year-old child. Apparently this two-year-old child was beaten every day for 7 weeks and was forced to eat dog turds dipped in tomato sauce. And these two members of the biker gang were found guilty and put in prison for that. And if we then sort of go over to the Mongrel mob, we see that in August 1981, I'll just read it to you so that I don't have to sort of waste some time thinking about it. On the 14th of June 1981, this is all off of their Wikipedia page, Mongrel mob Wellington leader Lester Epps awoke outside the gang pad. Epps had fought members of the Eastern Suburbs Rugby League Club at the Tramway Hotel the night before. Epps tried to flee through the Basin Reserve. However, he was ultimately caught and beaten. He died later in hospital. All people involved have received 18-month prison terms for manslaughter. In June 1987, Mongrel mob member Sam Teehee raped and murdered 16-year-old Colleen Burrows in Napier. In 1988, a young woman was kidnapped by the Mongrel mob and taken to a convention in Auckland, where she was subsequently raped by over 15 members of the gang.
Lovely.
And that
people,
sort of brought back thoughts of the thoughts of Rotherham when I read that, actually, which creates another bizarre bedfellows kind of connection between what took place in Queensland and what's been taking place elsewhere in the world. In 2003, members of the Maruparu Mongrel mob and the Tribesmen Motorcycle Club Maruparu chapters were involved in multiple methamphetamine laboratories that were raided by the police. On the 9th of September 2011, a member of the Waru Mongrel mob chapter fired a sawn-off shotgun at a local rugby club match because there were Black Power gang members in the audience. In August 2016, a 31-year-old Mongrel mob, a 31-year-old with Mongrel mob links and under the influence of methamphetamine and alcohol caused a crash of the taxi in Christchurch, injuring two people. And so it goes on. You know, I won't read you the whole list, but there is a list as, you know, quite a considerable list, as long as your forearm virtually. Not necessarily as long as your whole arm, but as long as your forearm. And, you know, it's the Mongol mob committing all sorts of hideous crimes, including, as I said before, gun running, including drug selling and assault and murder. And here they are welcomed and treated as respected members of the New Zealand community just because they're prepared to turn up and do a haka and doff their caps.
So they were given pride of place, were they? Were they, you know, were they right up the front? Was you know, was Sky TV or the BBC, did they sort of home in on it? Where did you hear about this?
Well, there have been a number of newspaper articles where they've provided also videos to accompany the newspaper articles that have shown the people sort of walking out to the front of the crowd and delivering these huckers, basically.
So they're right at the front then. Pride of place.
Well, it certainly appears so from the videos.
And it's just unbelievable, isn't it? Just unbelievable the lengths these people will go to try and to virtue signal and say we're not racist, even you know, really despicable criminal types, just because they're non-white, they're given a pass, they're sent to the front of the queue, just to atone for the evils of racism, I guess.
It may be that Jacinda Ardern hadn't invited these people to attend. It may be that they just incidentally attended. But obviously, they attended in a sufficiently prominent way so that the newspapers were there to video it, and so that they could get some positive kudos from the fact that they were there and they were seen as being and projected during these news articles and these videos as if they were decent, law-abiding members of society, and yet a little bit of investigation shows that they're not, and yet there's been no word from the New Zealand government to say that they feel that it is inappropriate that these biker gangs turn up, which is what you'd think that they would do.
Well, it's fine for them to turn up. What's inappropriate is to give them pride of place. And have them at the front doing their haka dances for the world's cameras, and the mainstream media to be crowing about it and saying, look how wonderful this is. You know, that's what's inappropriate. I would suggest it is appropriate if they want to turn up and mourn the dead and show their respects. But I don't think they should be given pride of place like that. And, you know, it highlighted and, you know, these are the wonderful people that we have in New Zealand. I mean, that's what's inappropriate about it. She's also been going crazy with the censorship. She's banned 8chan, 4chan, Dissenter, a couple of New Zealand websites. And just before we went on air, I read that she's actually banned Sky TV as well, Sky News, because they showed bits of the massacre or photographs of it or something like that. And she seems to be, I think, well, I mean, she's also refusing to name the killer. I think Brenton Tarrant, that was his name. She's refusing to name the killer, which just seems to me as if she thinks she's in a Harry Potter novel, like He Who Is Not to Be Named or whatever it was. And you've got to name these people. You've got to investigate them. You've got to see why they did what they did to try and prevent these things from happening again. She seems to me to be pretending that it hasn't happened. She's not going to name the person that did it. She's trying to get rid of all the evidence. She doesn't want anybody to see that this has happened. And I don't think that's the right way of dealing with it. I think it should be investigated thoroughly and people should be able to investigate it thoroughly. You know, I mean, some of the best investigators are the people on internet sites like Poll. I mean, they can find out incredible things about people because you've got like a crowdsource there that's trying to find out this information. I mean, there was an American actor, and he had some flag that he was putting up when Donald Trump first came in. And I forget the details of it now, but lots of people were trolling him and turning up where he had this flag. So he disappeared with it, and he went to he actually, I think it was in Britain at one point, in Liverpool or Manchester, and Paul managed to find him. They managed to locate this flag and where he was just from scanning CCTV. They've helped out with the people the invaders in America that are breaking into America. They've helped ICE out. They've managed to find out the identities of various Antifa that are wanted for violent crimes against nationalists. So they've managed to find out all the details from them. So you actually, on the internet, you've got people that could be finding out the information about this guy, more information about him. You can't just hide this stuff and pretend that it didn't happen. I can understand not wanting people to see people being killed. I can understand how upsetting that may be for relatives of the victims. But at the same time, you can't just pretend that it hasn't happened. I mean, it's been seen by millions of people. It was live streamed. Obviously we don't think that's good, but it's happened. You can't pretend that it hasn't. You can't pretend that it's not out there. And what you've got now is you've got a lot of journalists that have seen it, that were watching it at the time, that were interviewed the next day. And then you've got a lot of members of the public that haven't seen it, that don't know exactly what was going on. So you've got people that were saying, well, it was staged, it was a false flag, it didn't really happen. There were all sorts of conspiracy theories that are arising around it. And it just generates more interest in it, if anything. I think if she hadn't engaged in all this censorship, it certainly wouldn't have become such a big thing that it has become, with lots of people wanting to see it. I mean, over here in Britain, they're still using it as excuses for all sorts of articles, basically trying to blame right-wing commentators, right-wing influencers, even though they had nothing to do with this. The guy was radicalized by seeing the Islamic terrorism happening in Europe, particularly in Sweden, with Ebba Ekelund, when she was torn in half by a Muslim at the wheel of a truck that ran into a load of people. That is what radicalized him. It wasn't listening to podcasts or watching YouTube. You can say that it's this censorship, I think, that leads to activities like this. Because if you think about it, if you prevent somebody from being able to talk and you prevent them from having a voice, then the only recourse they have left to them is using their fists. And you can say that if they try to censor and silence all the right-wing dissent, everything that's right of center, then people are just going to take the law into their own hands, and they're going to think, well, there is no other solution. We're just left with making war, and you're going to get more of these attacks, which, we don't want. We certainly don't want them happening here at Radio Area, and we want to do all that we can to prevent these things from happening and say to people, you don't achieve anything. All you do is, you cause lots of trouble for the moderate nationalists, the non-violent nationalists that, totally abhor this sort of behaviour, because it doesn't do any help for us at all. I've got an article here which I found particularly interesting, which is actually from the Guardian, and it's attacking, again, it's attacking right-wing extremism and trying to make out that it's a much bigger threat than it actually is. They say thousands of Britons regularly use online forums that espouse right-wing extremism. It has emerged amidst fresh warnings that the UK is facing a new wave of anti-Muslim hatred. An indicator of the evolving challenge is the recent move by MI5 to wrest control from the police of investigations into far-right plots that cross the statutory threshold to be considered terrorism. The security services are currently investigating potential contact between the Christchurch gunman and right-wing extremists in the UK. And then they say, analysis by anti-fascist charity Hope Not Hate. Now, Hope Not Hate have been exposed by Tommy Robinson as making up news stories, making up fake news. They were exposed a couple of years back for inflating hate crime figures by something like 9,000 times as many hate crimes as there actually were. And yet the mainstream media still use these people as if they are an authority on things. So they're using apparent Hope Not Hate analysis here to indicate that huge numbers of Britons are among the global audience for far-right forums, such as Stormfront, which they call a white supremacist website that spreads extremist ideology. Stormfront, I mean, they don't even like to have racial slurs on their website, and they certainly don't spread violence or extremism. So this is false. And they say Sarah Khan, the UK's leading anti-extremism commissioner, has pointed to a fresh surge of UK-based far-right activists who are, she says, organised, professional, and actively attempting to recruit. Well, who are these UK-based far-right activists who are organised, professional, and actively attempting to recruit? I mean, if she's saying they're professional, that means that they're paid a wage for this. If she says they're actively attempting to recruit, I don't know of any extremist, nationalist extremists in Britain that are hoping to recruit. There was National Action who were banned. They're certainly not recruiting. They don't exist. The organisation of that wound the group up. Are they talking about Generation Identity here? Well, they are certainly not extremists. They're not even racial nationalists. They are civic nationalists. They're not extremists. So, and yet she says here that, you know, there are these groups here. She says she has visited 14 UK towns and cities, and she prepares a report on extremism for the Home Secretary. She told The Observer, "I have heard deep concern about the far right and its devastating impact on individuals, communities, and our democracy." And I would guess what she's done is go around the Muslim community, who will obviously exaggerate things like this. They will take any criticism as being a hate crime. She said a frightening amount of legal extremist content online was fueling far right activism. Well, if it's extremist, I mean, is it legal? I mean, what is the definition of extremist? Is it somebody that espouses violence as the solution? Because there is none of these organizations that say we should be using violence as a solution, or that, you know, we should be having a war or anything like that. None of these groups are saying that. The security services, having placed the threat from right-wing extremist ideology on a par with Islamist and Northern Ireland-related terrorism, have said they are investigating very sharp high-end cases in relation to the far right. So far, though, they have not revealed how many of the 700 or so live terror plots and 20,000 individuals classified as closed subjects of concern, people who have previously been investigated and may pose a future threat, are related to right-wing extremism. And I would guess the reason why they haven't revealed that is because it's a very, very tiny minority of it. And we get a confirmation of that here, buried in this article, which is trying to terrify everybody about this massive amount of far-right terrorism. It says, however, MI5 said the volume of right-wing cases was absolutely dwarfed by the number of Islamist cases. Absolutely dwarfed. And in the Daily Nationalist the other day, I reported on a report from Tony Blair from 2017, which showed that I think there was 80,000 victims of Islamic terrorism that year. And you could work out that the victims of so-called far-right terrorism is less than 1%. It's less than 1%. And yet the mainstream media is concentrating on this, trying to make it out to be the same threat that we're actually facing from Islamic terrorism, even when MI5 say that it's not, when they say it's the number of cases is absolutely dwarfed by the number of Islamist cases, they will still put out an article like this, which is saying the opposite, even though they've been told something completely different by MI5. They say the government's latest counter-terrorism assessment does, however, shed interesting light on the evolving far-right threat. Before 2014, it says, extreme right-wing activity in the UK was confined to small established groups with an older membership, which promoted anti-immigration and white supremacist views, but presented a very low risk to national security. Four extreme right-wing terror plots were foiled in the year to June 2018, fueling disquiet over online forums and their ability to disseminate extremist ideology. And I've looked into I look into any terror plots that are foiled that are supposed to be, well, I look into all of them, but particularly ones that are supposed to have been fomented by people on the far right. And I don't think any of them have been about their usage of online forums. It's all been private text apps and private messaging between them that's been used to as evidence against them in court. There's never actually been anything in public online forums. And then they say Joe Mulhall, a researcher for Hope Not Hate, said the global audience for chat rooms and messaging sites that effectively and quickly spread hate speech ran into the hundreds of thousands. We know that because we can look at the forums through which these people engage and see that they have hundreds of thousands of people in them, he said. And what they're trying to do there is say that, I mean, hate speech is obviously just criticism of minorities, and they're trying to conflate that with terrorism and make out that that is just as bad as terrorism. Whereas I would say that it's the preventing people from criticizing these things, preventing people from drawing attention to it, that's what causes the terrorism. It's the censorship.
Yeah, one of the other things that they don't seem to take into account in compiling these figures is that quite a lot of people who probably don't actually agree with nationalists, quite a lot of people who wouldn't regard themselves as nationalists at all, probably do have a look at nationalist websites, in the same way that at the beginning of this program I mentioned about how I read a wide variety of different materials from different sources, just in order to keep a broad outlook on things, just as I wouldn't regard myself as a typical Guardian reader, I don't think that we shouldn't assume that that everybody who visits a nationalist website is therefore going to be a nationalist supporter. And so just counting the activity on a nationalist website doesn't necessarily constitute a count of the number of people who are actually involved. The point that you make is very correct, that as far as nationalist organisations are concerned, there isn't a single nationalist organisation in this country that is planning any acts of terror. There are, you know, that sort of thing is just a figment of the imagination of people that the kind of people that write for Hope Not Hate, and the individuals that commit these sort of very sporadic attacks on ethnic minorities are individuals who don't belong to any nationalist organisations, who may have superficially gleaned enough information to cut and paste together in order to make some kind of a cranky manifesto, who feel desperate because they don't believe there's anything being done to address what they feel is desperately wrong with our society. And increasing the amount of censorship that exists on the internet, increasing the censorship that exists throughout the media generally in order to prevent nationalists from actually voicing our views and our opinions would be completely counterproductive, because it would give an even greater number of people who are desperate to find somebody who expresses views that concur with their own, create an even greater level of desperation amongst those people. And if it's desperation that they feel that nobody actually represents their views and that they have no legitimate role in politics that causes them to commit these kind of offences, then these kind of offences will increase just by virtue of what the liberals are suggesting should be done.
Well, when you think about it, when you think about actual far right terror plots, far right terrorist atrocities, you can think, well, there was Thomas Mayer that assassinated Joe Cox. Did he have a presence online? Was he using internet online forums? Was there any evidence at all that he even used the internet? No, there was no evidence of that. Then you've got Darren Osborne, who hired a van, drove it into London, drove outside a mosque, ran a Muslim over and killed him and scared a lot of others. That was another terrorist plot, terrorist atrocity. And he didn't have any presence online either. I don't know if he was even capable of using the computer. I mean, the guy had learning difficulties. He had something like 40 different offences against his name. And again, he was radicalized by the Manchester bombing, all the kids that were maimed by a nail bomb, and watching a BBC documentary. That's what he said in his scribbled note that was his manifesto found in his car. He said that it was through watching a BBC documentary on Rotherham and on the 1,400 girls that were raped in Rotherham by these grooming gangs. In each of those high-profile cases, it was nothing at all to do with the internet. And they tried to say that Tommy Robinson had radicalized Darren Osborne because he was signed up to Tommy Robinson's Twitter feed, and this was all reported in the mainstream media. But apparently, according to the court transcripts, that was those words were never spoken by the judge. They're not in the transcripts, and yet that was reported by the mainstream media. So it's the media that's pushing this idea that people are radicalized by talking online. And I would suggest talking online prevents this sort of thing from happening, and it means that if there is anybody that is unbalanced like that, I mean, it can be noticed, and the police could be notified. I mean, this has already happened. There was a plot a while back. There was somebody that was said that they were going to bomb their local pub because it was a gay pride demonstration, and the pub was going to be filled with homosexuals. And he had been talking about targeting this pub, and the chat room that he was in, they notified the police, and this attack was foiled. Now, if online chat rooms and nationalist talk online is banned and censored, you've got no chance of that ever happening again. That pub would have been blown up, though all the people inside it would have been killed. It's only because, you know, we have sensible people in these chat rooms. Nationalists are sensible people, and we know that, you know, attacks like this, they don't do us any favors. They make us look like unhinged terrorists. And we're not unhinged terrorists. We are normal people that love our race and that hold to the same traditions and values that our grandparents did and that every generation before our grandparents held to. You know, we're not crazies. It's the odd 1% of a 1% that are of a violent, unbalanced mindset in the first place that then see the things that are going on and see that we've got no representation, and they think, well, all hope is lost. I might as well go out in a blaze of glory. And they do something like this Brenton Tarrant has done. And, you know, and when you think about it, it's the more censorship there has been, the more of these terrorist attacks there have been. I mean, I called the attack last week, I called it a price tag attack, but it could just as well have been an Islamic terrorist attack, and it would still have been a price tag attack, because it's the price that we pay for living with diversity. Whether these terrorist attacks come from Muslims against white Christians, whether they come from white supremacists against Muslims, they could not happen if we still had homogenous societies. You know, they don't have Islamic terrorism in Japan because they don't have any Muslims in Japan. You know, if we didn't have diverse societies filled with all different peoples from all over the world, there wouldn't be any chances for, you know, ethnic or religious-based terrorism to occur. And we're told that, you know, terrorism is just part and parcel of living in a big city now. That's what Sadiq Khan has told us. And that's what he's telling us. He's telling us that terrorism is the price that we pay for diversity. That's the price that we pay for kebabs and curries, basically, is that terrorist incident could occur, which is a terrible state of affairs. But the only way to prevent it is to remove the people that are likely to cause the terrorism. Either remove the people who are going to cause the terrorism, or remove the people who are going to be the victims of that terrorism. So you end up moving Muslims back to their own countries and then leave them alone in those countries. I mean, that's the reason for a lot of the Islamic terrorism in Europe, besides the fact that we've actually got Muslims here that can carry it out. They are aggrieved at Europe's behaviour in their own countries. They're aggrieved at Europe's behaviour in Syria, Iraq, Libya, and all these terrible wars that have taken place. The Muslims in Europe justify their attacks against us because of the behaviour of our countries in their homelands. And again, that shows you their loyalty is to their homelands, their loyalty is to their people. It's not to us. It doesn't matter if they have you know, a piece of paper saying that they're British. They're not British. Their loyalty is to their people. One of the other things I've noticed about all this, Max, is their attempt, the mainstream media's attempts to sort of debunk nationalist talking points. And one of the most bizarre ones I saw, because we talk about white genocide, we talk about the Great Replacement, and the Great Replacement comes from United Nations, and they actually call the migration that they are forcing on Europe replacement migration. So that's why it's called the Great Replacement. But one article that I saw was saying, white people are going to be a minority in their own homelands in 30 or 40 years. But it's not correct to say that whites might become a minority, because we don't know whether the offspring of the whites and the non-whites will consider themselves white or not. And I thought, well, that's like saying we don't know whether a mule is actually a horse, because we don't know if the mule considers itself a horse or if it considers itself a mule. You know, a mule is a mule. A non-white person is a non-white person. It doesn't matter what they consider themselves to be. And that's the point of this. I mean, this is an existential threat that white people are facing of becoming a minority in our homelands. And they are not able to counter that. I saw another article, and this was in The Independent, and it was saying the problem is that these nationalists, they don't know how to make use of this. They don't know how to capitalize on the fact that they're going to be a minority. I mean, what way is there to capitalize on it? They said they don't understand the wonderful prospects of that. What wonderful prospects are there of becoming a minority? There are no wonderful prospects, are there?
Now, the wonderful prospects only exist for people who are global industrial leaders who want to have a large population of cheap labour in Western countries. That they're the only people that actually benefit from mass immigration, and obviously they're the people who own the newspapers and the news media, and so therefore it's their view and their point of view that's being put out as if it is a legitimate point of view that everybody should hold, whereas as we all know, it's not.
Yeah, I think that maybe they're saying, well, you're not realizing that you've got lots of black and brown people here that you could be having sex with and then just have brown children, and then it won't be a problem. And I think that's I think at the root of a lot of it. I mean, Sarkozy said that the problems of racism wouldn't be solved until everybody's miscegenated, and there should be a law to force people to miscegenate. And I think maybe that is a part of this. These SJWs and the liberals and the globalists, they think, well, that's one way to get rid of racism is if everybody is miscegenated. Well, the goal of Radio Aryan is to prevent that from happening. I was thinking about this the other day. You know, if just one person can be prevented from destroying their bloodline by going with a Negro or a non-white, then I'm happy. My job's done. You know, Radio Aryan has achieved what it set out to achieve, because that can never be undone. You know, we may not be able to take our countries back. We may not have political representation. But so long as we don't have non-white children, you know, we're okay. We've succeeded. That is the most important thing, is that you don't destroy your bloodline. Max, I don't know if you want to add anything else to today to finish with, or if you sort of said everything that you'd like to.
Yeah, I've pretty much said everything that I need to. I think I agree wholeheartedly with what you've said, that the problem of interracial terrorism and interethnic terrorism only exists because of multiculturalism. It's a product of multiculturalism. A multicultural society, because of social dynamics, inevitably sets up each ethnic minority or racial minority in competition with the other racial and ethnic minorities. It inevitably does it, and it inevitably that then results in each ethnic minority competing for a larger share of the finite resources that exist in each of the Western countries, because throughout the whole of the world now we live in a world of finite resources. Those people who talk about green issues are always telling us that we live in a world of finite resources, and we have to recognize that as far as providing for that the people that live in the world, that we do have a world of finite resources, and if we give our resources away, then we are diminishing that which is available to our own people. And if you live in a world of finite resources, then political kudos can only be gained by ethnic minority leaders by winning an ever-increasing share of that finite resource for their people. And so they're in competition with the leaders of other ethnic groups. And it's this that stirs antagonisms between racial groups and ethnic groups, because being conscious of this filters down to the people in the street. And people in the street, you know, although they may not necessarily be academically gifted, that they will still have the intelligence necessary to understand this sort of basic issue, that if the jobs in the society in which they live, and the houses and accommodation within the society in which they live, and the social benefits within the society in which they live are being whittled away and are being spread ever more thinly over an increasingly large number of people who have come to their country, who are strangers in their country, then inevitably they're going to realise that this is something that they have to struggle to try and rectify, and that they've got to struggle to try and retain the share of those finite resources that is due to their people. And it's this fundamental issue that is at the root of all of the inter-ethnic strife, and that is the root of the inter-ethnic terrorism, etc., that we see. And sooner or later, people who are on the liberal side of the political spectrum have got to recognise that this is the issue that they've got to wrestle with. And there really is only one answer, and that is for people to live in their own countries, and for us to agree that our own individual homelands are for ourselves alone.
If we don't put our own interests first, nobody else is going to. We have to provide for ourselves first. And every other race understands that. It's just white people that seem to have forgotten it. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. And until then, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
To the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.